The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi Canada, I'm Hugh Hewitt. This is the rundown. The COVID variant Delta, that's the fourth variant of the COVID virus, has swept across Europe and England and has now invaded America, and it is now accounting for 20% of the cases. Expect that to be 50% of the cases in the United States before 2 weeks. It is not deadlier than the already deadly COVID virus, but it certainly is deadly. And you have got the opportunity to go get a vaccine. They are free. They are cheap. They are available everywhere. You can walk into a drugstore. You can go and get it today. If you're over 16, just go there and get it. Especially take your mom and dad, take your grandma and your grandpa. Make sure they are vaccinated. Enjoy the summer. Don't worry about it. The Delta variant is nothing to screw around with. COVID is nothing to screw around with. The White House announced yesterday we will not make the July 4th goal of 70% vaccination in the United States. That doesn't mean you have to gamble. Don't gamble. Go get the vaccine. 153 people resigned rather than get the vaccine from the Houston Methodist Hospital System. 24,947 workers did get vaccinated. So the 153, I appeal to you. I don't know why you didn't. There's no good science on your side. Go and get vaccinated. Also, a story in the New York Times today about Ellie Oster, an economist at Brown University, who had lots to say during the shutdown. Just because you get vaccinated doesn't mean you give up your critiques of everything that happened during the pandemic year, especially the closings of the school. It's a fine profile of a courageous woman who made the case and continues to make the case that the school shutdowns were an enormous mistake, and we have to end them and not repeat that mistake in future pandemics. The voting rights fraud bill failed. I call it a fraud because it was. It was simply an attempt by Democrats to seize every federal election in the United States, roll over the states, enforce amazing public expenditures on candidates, which nobody supports. Immediately after it failed, after the Republicans filibustered it, the Democrats began to change their music on voting identification. They've read the polls. They realize even 62% of Democrats favor voter ID. They'll soon be back. And by the way, Major League Baseball, too bad you took the game away from Atlanta and became a blue sport when everyone realizes that voter registration, voter identification are very good things indeed. Meanwhile, in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott has called a special session to renew the push for easy to vote, hard to cheat legislation in Texas. Easy to vote, hard to cheat legislation is already passed in Arizona and in Georgia. Easy to vote, hard to cheat legislation will pass soon in Texas. Thank you, Governor Abbott. Delta COVID-19 variant could be dominant in the United States in 2 to 3 weeks. 50%, as I said, that's in the Wall Street Journal. On inflation, a lot of mixed news yesterday. The Fed's chair, Jerome Powell, played down the inflation threat in a hearing before Congress. Bridgewater's Bob Prince, he runs Bridgewater Associates with Ray Dalio and Greg Jensen, told the Financial Times that long-running deflationary forces will curtail recent price rises and that inflation will be moderate, something with which I don't agree because I look at something like this. U.S., according to the Wall Street Journal, U.S. existing home prices hit a record high in May, Year-over-year price increase, the highest ever. 24% higher than a year ago in 1 year in every category. That also led the Financial Times house prices climb to record levels in U.S. and Europe. Not an American thing. So to Prince's idea that this might be an American inflationary burst, take a look at European house prices. Blackstone, one of the world's great investments firms, has now acquired Home Partners of America because they know that U.S. housing is a great, great investment. So they bought Home Partners of America for $6 billion. It's a buyer and operator of single-family rental properties. Another 17,000 homes go into the Blackstone portfolio. Google, faces European problems, an antitrust probe of alleged ad tech abuses. Google is the latest of the big tech people to fall under the scrutiny. The Wall Street Journal is praising Justice Gorsuch's antitrust tutorial in the opinion slamming the NCAA earlier this week. In brushing back the NCAA, he and the Supreme Court offered good advice to other judges, according to the Journal. It's an absolute must-read if you're a lawyer. If you're not a lawyer, all you need to know is that the NCAA is a cartel and will be dealt as such. Jason Gay, the great sports columnist for the Journal, has a terrific column. The NCAA, the Supreme Court, a duck and a bicycle. There's an old saying, writes Gay, if you see a duck riding a bicycle, and I see a duck riding a bicycle, sometimes you still need the Supreme Court to unanimously say that it sees a duck riding a bicycle, too. Okay, fine. Duck on a Bike may be the title of a children's book by David Shannon, but it above is not an old saying, I made it up. Still, that's effectively what happened Monday, as the nation's highest court confirmed what any reasonable person can see, that big-time intercollegiate athletics is a warped, hard-to-defend product. It's a cartel. It needs to be broken up. The Journal also editorialized against the attack on the Alzheimer's drug, Aduhelm, Biogen's new drug for Alzheimer's. I cannot believe people are criticizing the availability of this drug. They've obviously never had a parent or a family member or a spouse with Alzheimer's. I have. My father-in-law had Alzheimer's. And I will tell you, anything that might work would have been a relief. You do not want to hold back from the public the opportunity to choose. You have to pay for it as well. The people on the left who do not want it out there simply want to control and ration health care and do not want to spend money on people diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's or late onset Alzheimer's. Do not let the left run American medicine. They will turn it into a scarcity program that simply does not value the elderly. It's contrary to everything we believe in American liberty and most Christian sects. The TV hit isn't just dying, it may already be dead, says the Washington Post. I did not watch The Mayor of Easton. Maybe you did. It was a huge success, but only 4 million people. Now, 4 million people are going to listen to this radio show today. 4 million people will listen. The Mayor of Easttown on their big end-of-season show, 4 million people. So I ask you, what has happened to the national news audience, the national entertainment audience? It's shattered. It will not come back. You might get some sports events that reach the level of, say, presidential debates. They will never reach the level of radio. They will never reach the level of Joe Rogan and the best podcast, like my two podcasts, The Rundown with Hugh Hewitt and The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Podcasts are destroying television. Television is being eaten away by niche viewing, and that's good for people like individual choice. It's bad for the news business, but it's very good for radio shows focused on breaking news like this one. Bad news out of Afghanistan, where militias are sweeping across Afghanistan's north and are reforming in Afghanistan's north to stop a sweep by the Taliban. The Taliban has resurged in about a half dozen provinces in the north, and longtime dormant warlords are rising to meet the challenge. Civil war is returning to Afghanistan, even as the United States prepares to pull its last helicopter out of Bagram Air Force Base. Michael Gove, one of the key players in the British cabinet, announced definitively yesterday that Boris Johnson will not grant a new Scottish referendum on independence before the next election, which must come no later than 2024. The Scots Independence Party lost their one chance. They don't get two chances. You don't get do-overs in a national referendum where everyone thinks about it, everyone considers it. Their argument that, well, we were in the European Union then, is not availing, is not material. They didn't want to leave. They should not be allowed a second chance. Good for Boris Johnson. In Israel, the new coalition government managed to stub its toe big time yesterday, allowing a debate on from occupation to apartheid in the Knesset. The event was hosted by member of the Knesset, Ida Tuma Sleeman, a member of the joint list, the opposition, and N.K. Mosi Raz of Meretz, a member of the coalition that's part of Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's government. It degenerated into a shouting match of insults and invective between left and right. Not good for the obvious people of watching closely whether the coalition will stay together. Very good for Benjamin Netanyahu and opposition. Finally, Bermuda. Wonderful Bermuda. the object of my desire when I ever enter into another presidential administration where I want to be counsel general. Bermuda's political and business elite is responding to the G7 push for the minimum corporate tax as it would approach of an Atlantic hurricane, according to the Financial Times. Officials are looking to ride out the storm and keep intact a 19th century revenue regime that leaves company profits untouched. Bermuda has a right to determine for itself what it thinks is an appropriate tax system for its jurisdiction. We have a system in place for 200 years. It's not perfect, says the finance minister, Curtis Dickinson. It does require some adjustment, but we will do on our own and not have someone tell us to change our system to fit some global initiative. I would say it's a sovereignty issue. Good for you, Bermuda. I'm on the way eventually, I hope. Neither are Northern Ireland. Neither one requires confirmation by the Senate. And I look forward to serving the people of Bermuda or Northern Ireland with great conviction. Either that or deputy counsel to the White House and the president, so I can get my handicap down to 2, like Dick Houser. But stay tuned, America. I'll be right back. Welcome back, America. To Hewitt. It's a great night for Cavaliers fans, Cleveland, and Ohio sports fans in general, because finally the Cavs got some lotto magic back, ended up picking number 3 in a talent-loaded NBA draft next month. Probably Jalen Green will end up there, the G League guard going to join Colin Sexton, Darius Garland, and a group of just amazing young basketball players in Cleveland, and all to the good. All to the good. Detroit and Tim Alberta, congratulations. You get Cade Cunningham. Houston, congratulations. You get Mr. Mobley from USC, but it's a USC product. Nevertheless, Jalen Green scoring. The next Kobe, many people say, going to Cleveland. Love that, love that, love that. Check in what maybe presidential nominees for the Republican Party had to say yesterday. First, Tom Cotton on the Senate floor talking about the filibuster, cut number 7.
So then you have a lot of Democrats who are complaining that the Senate rules and customs, the filibuster, has to go. They say that it's a racist relic of the Jim Crow era. I will acknowledge that some Democrats over the years used the filibuster to block civil rights progress. But I'll also remind my Democratic colleagues that, yes, they used the filibuster hundreds of times in the last administration. I'll also enter into the record with request for consent, Mr. President, this letter written on April 7, 2017. Persuasively authored by Susan Collins and Chris Coons and signed by more than 60 of our fellow senators, urging Senator McConnell and Senator Schumer to preserve the existing rules, practices, and traditions as they pertain to rights and members to engage in extended debate on legislation. They note that these rules have changed on our executive calendar when we consider judicial nominees or executive branch nominees. But they say we are mindful of the unique role the Senate plays in the legislative process, and we are steadfastly committed to ensuring that this great institution continues to serve as the world's greatest deliberative body. Therefore, we are asking you, Senator Schumer and Senator McConnell, we are asking you to join us in opposing any effort to curtail the existing rights and prerogatives of senators to engage in full, robust, and extended debate as we consider legislation before this body in the future. Let me remind you, more than 60 senators signed this. 26 Democrats currently serving in the Senate signed it. 27, if you include the vice president. Let me just give you a few notables. As I said, the vice president signed it. The following chairs of Senate committees signed this letter 4 short years ago. Senators Leahy, Warner, Cantwell, Carper, Reid, Stabenow, and Menendez.
Ah, well put, Senator Cotton. Another would-be president in the top tier, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, cut number 27.
Curriculum can really provide a guide to how that should be done. The bill also expands our previous efforts in civics to add a requirement for the high school government class that students receive instruction on the evils of communism and totalitarian ideologies. We have a number of people in Florida, particularly southern Florida, who've escaped totalitarian regimes, who've escaped communist dictatorships, to be able to come to America. We want all students to understand the difference. Why would somebody flee across shark-infested waters, say, leaving from Cuba to come to southern Florida. Why would somebody leave a place like Vietnam? Why would people leave these countries and risk their life to be able to come here? It's important that students understand that. Now, as part of this bill, Florida will create a Portraits and Patriotism Library so students can learn about real patriots who came to this country after seeing the horrors of these communist regimes. We actually have folks here today. You'll hear from her in a minute, Anna Abauza. She came to the United States when she was a teenager, fleeing from Nicaragua when the Sandinistas brought socialism to that country. She graduated from the University of Florida.
Good for Ron DeSantis. This is an important and necessary education innovation following what Doug Ducey did in Arizona. A high school senior in Arizona, in order to get their diploma, must pass the test that any would-be American citizen has to pass to naturalize and become an American citizen. That was the first of many great education reforms in the state of Arizona. Governor DeSantis following in Doug Ducey's footpath. Teach communism. Teach its evil. I'll be right back on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. That is, of course, John Andrazik of Five for Fighting singing. Five for Fighting announced a new concert tour, the first in over a year and a half. Hooray. He's also coming to the Birchmere in Alexandria, Virginia, so I'll be able to see him. I'm joined now by Leland Vittert, News Nation Now anchor. Good morning, Leland. How are you?
Good morning. Good talking to you.
You know, Leland, since you were last on, many people have asked me, what is News Nation Now? So I've been explaining what you explained, but I don't think we can tell people often enough there's a new competitor in town. You want to give the short summary of News Nation Now?
Short story, a company that owns 200 local news stations around the country has created its own cable news network, which you can find by going to newsnationnow.com. Click on Channel Finder. If you've got cable, you have it. And we're trying to do something unusual in America right now, which is to do journalism the old-fashioned way on cable news, which is to give you the information and the facts and tell you what the news is rather than just give you opinion and let you be angry about something.
I have described it as old-school journalism, meaning just the facts. Walter Cronkite, John Chancellor, David Brinkley, Chet Hundley, and older people love that. A lot of people have stopped watching this. Have you seen the cable ratings, Leland?
I have every day.
And so what do you think is going on in America that they're turning off cable news?
Well, a couple of things. One, people can get whatever information they want. Two, if you want opinion, there's phenomenal shows like yours that we're on right now to come to. Journalists make lousy media critics as a rule. And I try not to involve myself in that. And focus on what we just talked about, which is being an old school journalist. And if you want to be good at something, you got to do it all the time. And that's what I at least try to do with my days and my life, and then leave the critics part to everything else. It's interesting that journalism in the independent and the independent sense, we'll put it like that, in non-political sense, the demand for that started in the 1930s and 1940s as the times in America became more and more important, and the luxury of being divided and being partisan of the roaring 20s and earlier didn't exist anymore. And that's when independent, meaningful journalism became more and more important and gave sense to the word that you use, which is old school journalism.
Leland Vittert is my guest. Now, Leland, Don Lemon is an old colleague of mine from CNN. I've done his show 1,000 times until I joined NBC. He was on Firing Line with Margaret Hoover. Yes, it still exists. People don't watch it, but it's there. And Don Lemon said this: I would like to have your analysis of it. Cut number 4.
You are the commander in chief, the president of the United States of America, the greatest country on earth. Act like it.
This is CNN Tonight. I'm Don Lemon. The president of the United States is racist. All of us already knew that.
The president of the United States is a fraud and a con man.
When you interject that emotion and you call the president of the United States a con man, how is that different from the emotion that Fox News interjects when they're covering Biden?
Yeah. Well, because I'm coming from a place of truth. Because when I say that the president of the United States is racist, I went on after that to give the evidence, right, I could have started, I probably did, with the housing discrimination lawsuit that he and his father faced. I could have done the Central Park Five or the Exonerated Five. I think I probably went on to talk about his role in birtherism. And so I gave the evidence of that. When I say that the president of the United States is a fraud and a con, that was looking at his taxes and how he and his history of litigation and not paying people. These are all facts. I don't do opinion.
He says, I don't do opinion. What do you think of that, Leland Vitter?
Well, I think the reason that we have an opportunity is because cable news does opinion. And that we're making a bet that old school journalism is going to experience a renaissance because there's a lack of it and there's a demand for it. And I'll go back to what I said. Journalists make lousy media critics. And I think one of the things that we don't do at News Nation is we're not media critics. And if there's a number of channels that at any given point you can turn to and listen to people give both their opinion and critique the other side and critique the coverage of the other side. And now we've gotten to the point where they're critiquing the coverage of the other side, critiquing them.
Yes.
Okay. I'm of the opinion that people in Decatur, Illinois, and St. Louis, Missouri, and Waterloo, Iowa, and I'll go through a list of a billion other small towns that I spent time in growing up, care probably about zero about people in New York who make millions of dollars on their cable television shows talking about how each other talks about each other. It's just boring.
And it doesn't, Leland, you grew up in Iowa, Illinois, and Missouri, and you went to school at Northwestern.
I grew up in Missouri, but I spent a lot of time in Illinois, Iowa, Arkansas, a little bit of time in Tennessee growing up, a lot of time in Georgia.
And then you went to Northwestern.
I did.
So you don't know anything about college football.
Well, except for the fact that in my later time, I become a huge Nick Saban fan.
All right. Well, that's not college football. That's organized crime. Let me turn to the two stories that I wanted to straighten out.
Well, okay.
It's true. I'm from Ohio. We know that. Go Bucks. Leland, in terms of two stories for Straight News reporting, what happened in the Senate yesterday when S1 was considered?
What happened was is it failed, which we all knew it would. And you got to wonder, why bring a vote up that you know is going to fail? And this was Chuck Schumer trying to make a point and perhaps trying to – well, he was definitely trying to motivate the progressive wing of the Democratic Party to put pressure on a couple of key senators, Kristen Sinema, Joe Manchin among them, to be willing to break the filibuster and to sort of hold anyone who is not willing to wholesale change voting in America out to ridicule as being a racist. Now – You can debate the policy back and forth about whether or not voting in America needs to change, et cetera, but there's a difference between changing the way voting is done in America and changing the way laws are made in America. And you're watching one being used to sort of bully a couple of senators into changing the other.
Now, there was a continuous refrain from Democrats, from the Speaker and Majority Leader Schumer down to the lowest ranking in either house, that democracy's future was on the line yesterday. Was democracy's future on the line yesterday, Leland Vittert?
If you listen to both sides right now, you hear that refrain a lot, that the country is on the line, democracy is on the line, on and on and on. I think the Republic now is 238 years old, 239 coming up here in a couple of days. Or 240. And if I'm doing my math correctly, it's a little early for it. We've experienced a lot of challenges to our democracy. One has to wonder if asking for an ID before you go and vote, which is the most sacred thing that we as Americans are allowed to do, is somehow challenging our democracy. Again, that's a policy question. That's a political question. And our job, to go back briefly to what we talked about before, is to provide people the facts, which we just did, about IDs and the age of the Republican. Let people decide for themselves. And if they believe that, then that tells you where to stand. If you don't believe that, that tells you where to stand.
I'm talking with Leland Vittert. You can follow him at L-E-L LeandVittert, Leland Vittert. There's a T at the end of Vittert. And you can follow NewsNationNow.com to find out where you can watch the new cable player with old school journalism, just the facts journalism. Let's turn to COVID. I began the show this morning, Leland, by citing the statistics on the rapid rise of the Delta variant, expected to be the major COVID source within a month. It's now 20% of the cases in the United States. It swept across Europe, began in India. It is not deadlier, though it is deadly, than the original Alpha COVID variant or any of the other variants, but it is much more contagious, raising the level of risk to Americans everywhere who have not gotten vaccinated. The Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson vaccines are efficacious against it. What do you think is the bottom line message for Americans about the vaccines and the Delta variant?
I'm not a doctor. All I can say is that you're talking to somebody who spent a week in the hospital with COVID and was at times in very rough shape. And if people want to get vaccinated, they can get vaccinated. If they don't, they won't. That's the freedom we have in America. So there you go. What I think is
Leland, I didn't know that. When did you get COVID?
I got COVID in January and ended up in the hospital for a week and was quite sick with it. And I like many people my age, who 38 years old and healthy and with no comorbidities and all the things that we all said, hey, it can't happen to us because we're healthy and on and on and on and on. Got very sick, and there's people in my position who died and who have been affected for long periods of time and on and on and on. So I think people make whatever decision they want to make, but know that the consequences are significant and real, or at least very well can be.
You know, Leland, I did not know you'd had it. You are now the youngest serious case. Now, I've had friends and colleagues who died from COVID, and they were all over 65, but I had not yet talked to a young, healthy, no comorbidity person who ended up in the hospital. Did you go into ICU?
I did not. I mercifully did not go into ICU. I was lucky enough to get remdesivir, and that really turned things around. But there was a night or two that things were quite scary. And had I not gotten remdesivir, things would have taken potentially a negative turn. So it's personal for me, but again, it's personal for everybody. I think if we go back to be as well informed as you can, and the part of the problem with the COVID messaging is so much of what we've been told is wrong, right? And it's very difficult to believe stuff when you've been told things by experts that turned out to be so grossly wrong, and people said it with such confidence. You know, they were, at the time, things that were being said about COVID were seldom right, but the people were saying it was never in doubt.
Well, that's what I say about talk radio. Frequently wrong, never in doubt. That's what it takes to be a talk radio show host. And I'm only half joking about half of the talk show hosts out there, but you're right about public health authorities. Frequently wrong, never in doubt. Now, they have to be because someone wants an answer. But Leland, you just did more to get people vaccinated or listen to this show than anyone else. I appreciate that very much. Leland Vittert, my friends, is at News Nation Now. You can watch him as the show expands, as the network expands. Make sure you tune into it and make it a regular stop, as Leland will be making a regular stop here. Leland Vittert of News Nation Now. Time for me to tell you about one of our great sponsors, ReliefFactor.com. Every single day, I take this. Got a quick trip this weekend. Kurt Schlichter will be in for me on Monday because I'm on a four-day weekend. Because I get off the air Friday at 9, I can count it as a four-day weekend. These four little pills, taken at once, don't do anything about COVID or serious disease, but boy, do they help prevent the soreness that comes, the temporary discomfort that comes with exercise. After the show, it'll be 6 miles this morning in the humidity of the Beltway. Yesterday it rained, so I couldn't get my four in, so I got to do six today. And I'll tell you, ReliefFactor.com operates on everyone regardless of age. If you are in any way exercising, and if you're getting older, and that's everyone out there, ReliefFactor.com is for you. Join the tens of thousands of people, including me, who take it every single morning. ReliefFactor.com. Come right back, America. Lots more ahead on today's Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Congressman Mike Gallagher. Representative Gallagher is, of course, from the 1st District of Wisconsin. He is rooting for America's team last week, but America's team last week that beat the Nets is now going to lose to the Hawks. Congressman, thank you for dispatching the Nets. We're glad to have the Bucks do the job that needed doing, but I'm not very optimistic about your team when it comes up against the mighty Hawks.
Since when are you a Hawks fan, Hugh? This is really... This
because
is
they're against the Bucks.
Polygamy is what we're witnessing here. Shameless order here.
Well, the Cavs drafted number three. They won the lotto last night, so I'm actually kind of ecstatic. If they trade Jalen Green, I'm done with him. But Jalen Green with our young core, forget it. The Bucks are done. You better win this time because the Cavs are back. Congressman, I have two serious subjects for you. First of all, this morning's Post reports that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said yesterday that he will work with Congress to remove sexual assault prosecutions from the military justice system. I talked with Admiral Stavridis about this yesterday. The admiral's in favor of this, but it comes only days after Army General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Marine Corps Commandant David Berger both warned that doing so might undermine military justice. You are a Marine. What do you think?
Well, I'm also ranking member of the Military Personnel Subcommittee, and so I'm going to hold my fire a little bit because we want to have a hearing in which we entertain both sides and get the arguments of the Joint Chiefs, because it wasn't just Milley. It was actually all the members of the Joint Chiefs that argued against this. And their concern, as I understand it, is that this could erode really the bonds of trust within units as well as just the inherent authority of the chain of command by taking sexual assault cases out of the chain of command and putting them under civilian review and civilian control. You know, that being said, I will say that there is a bipartisan group in Congress, Mike Turner in the House, Trent Kelly as well, that has been working not only in a bipartisan fashion, but in a bicameral fashion with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand to fix some of the concerns in her original bill, you know, minimize any unintended consequences. And so we have a really unique situation here where, you know, the Joint Chiefs has one opinion, the secretary himself has another opinion. And in the committee, we're going to try and figure out, well, is there a middle ground here or is it just black or white one way or the other? And I've not yet made my decision on which way I'm going to fall.
Well, neither have I, Congressman. I know that I counseled some university presidents and college presidents during the period of time that the review process for sexual assault and harassment on campuses was underway to get out of the business, that they're ill-equipped for it and turn it over to the local police department whenever an allegation is made. I don't know how that would work on a ship at sea. That's really actually my greatest concern. You can remove someone from the battlefield, but you can't really remove a suspect from a ship easily, can you?
No. I mean, depending on what operational environment you're in, you know, which illustrates, I think, why we have a unique system under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And at times, the attempts to draw a perfect parallel or analogy to the civilian justice system simply don't work because the UCMJ has unique provisions within it for good reason. And so that's what makes this so difficult. There's no question, I think, Hugh, that we need to pay more serious attention to sexual assault, sexual harassment in the military. We can't have any tolerance for it. Marines, soldiers, sailors, or airmen need to hold themselves to the highest ethical standard possible. They need to keep their honor clean. I myself served in a unit that did not have females in it because my military occupational specialty didn't allow females at the time. So I don't have as much direct experience with it. But certainly when I was deployed downrange, anytime you were at a forward operating base or a major base that, you know, had men and women in it, things happened that created tension in units and that had to be dealt with. And that's what makes this so very, very difficult. How do you preserve good order and discipline? How do you preserve esprit de corps? How do you preserve the authority of unit commanders and the unique aspects of the Uniform Code of Military Justice while at the same time cracking down on a very real problem?
Now, this is a unique issue where the hearing will be useful. I look forward to that hearing. Now, let me turn to the Taliban and the very bad news. They are sweeping across provinces in the north, reestablishing their control. Warlords are reforming in the north of Afghanistan. They are also seizing provinces in the south. My immediate concern are translators in those areas and others threatened by a return of the Taliban getting to the United States with their families, because if they don't, they are dead men and women walking. What is happening to the bill that Mike Waltz, I believe you co-authored it as well? Where is that?
Well, it's caught in the machinery of the House right now. And I know it's not just Waltz and Republicans on my side of the aisle. There are Democrat veterans like Jason Crow who are also pushing the bill and trying to make an argument to their own leadership, Pelosi, to see that it moves forward expeditiously. And I just think we need to take a step back here as the situation gets worse and understand exactly what's happening, which is to say, in my opinion, Hugh, this sort of well-intentioned effort to minimize U.S. presence and thereby save money and allow us to focus on the rising threat of China and deprioritize other areas of the world, such as Afghanistan, is really proving counterproductive. Because, as you know, assets that we have in the Pacific, particularly an aircraft carrier, are being forced to relocate in order to cover the withdrawal in Afghanistan. And so if we see increasing chaos in this region, well, you can kiss your desire to pivot to the Pacific and refocus our force presence on Indo-Pacific goodbye, because you're just going to be dealing with chaos in Afghanistan, chaos in the Middle East because you misunderstood the alliance structure. And so thus far, though it's too early to tell, I will say this seems to be failing even on its own terms, because, you know, Biden just raised the white flag, did a preemptive surrender, and thereby gave a gift to our adversaries, the Taliban foremost among them.
Also in Iran, Raisi has become the new president. According to everyone I know who knows Iran, he is also the designated successor to Khamenei. He is a killer. He is a terrorist. And of the regime's public face. Why are we still having Wendy Sherman in Vienna negotiating another bailout of the mullahs?
And considering giving them cash on the front end and sanctions relief in return for no serious concessions, in return for the illusory promise of concessions to come. This is fantasy land. This is the definition of insanity, because it is the same people doing the same thing again and expecting a dramatically different outcome. And the fact that we have a hardliner winning an election, I just think proves the direction that the regime is going. Remember, the entire premise of this, Hugh, going back to 2013, really 2011, was that by getting the Iranians hooked on cash, you would somehow empower the moderates or the reformers within the regime, and suddenly you would see a nicer, kinder, gentler Iranian regime. Well, the exact opposite happened. And even when more moderates won, than the current leadership won elections, they were controlled by the supreme leader. I mean, the supreme leader is the ultimate source of all power and authority. The IRGC Quds Force was an instrument of the supreme leader, not of the Iranian president. So we misunderstood the nature of domestic politics in Iran. And we misunderstood the fact that we have a strong hand to play, because persistently for the last few years, there have been protests within Iran. There are Iranian people that are rising up against the deprivations and the repression of their evil regime. The fact that they see all of this this money that they've gotten in sanctions relief being spent on financing terrorism as opposed to being spent on doing things to improve their daily life, that gives us an opportunity. And I think what we learned when President Trump took Qasem Soleimani off the battlefield, which was a very gutsy decision, it was the right decision, is that when we realize that we are the superpower in this relationship and that Iran is a third-rate power at best, deterrence can work. Deterrence can hold. And the Iranians, through their own incompetence, shot down tragically a commercial airliner when they thought there was an incoming missile from the Americans. So it is long past time for us to step away from the negotiating table before the Biden administration agrees to something incredibly stupid, something that empowers the Iranian regime, that imperils our allies in the region. And look at the chaos that we saw in the recent months between Israel and Hamas. Hamas, we know, is getting support, even though they are a Salafi jihadist Sunni terrorist group. They're getting support from the Shiite regime in Iran. This is an alliance against our interests, an alliance against Israel's interest, and an alliance that is designed to destroy the foundation of the Abraham Accords, which is the foundation we need to be building off of, not undermining right now, as the Biden administration is intent on doing.
Yeah, you know, Congressman, what is your understanding of the motivation? This is a serious question. I do not understand Wendy Sherman. I do not understand anyone who wants to deal with the regime that is as malign as the Iranian. You might deal with Russia. You might deal with China as a superpower. But this is simple appeasement. What is their belief? We tried the Hail Mary and they accelerated everything and they put missiles off limits and they've said they won't stop funding the Houthis, Hamas and Hezbollah. Why are we still there?
Well, I think there's sort of a sunk cost fallacy in some of this. I mean, these people have poured the better part of their professional lives into getting the Iran deal to somehow work. And the fact that the previous administration, the Trump administration, abandoned it has not deterred them from trying to put it back together with duct tape. So, so much of their own reputation and their intellectual self-worth is bound up in this thing working, even against all evidence. And then I will say, I think there are still true believers in the Obama theory, what is called the new equilibrium theory. Obama sincerely believed that by allowing Iran to take a bigger role in the region and balancing Iran against our traditional allies, the Israelis and the Sunni Arab Gulf states, that you could actually produce a more stable balance of power in the Middle East. That was the new equilibrium that he sought. But the fact is, it produced disequilibrium. So I think there are a lot of people in the administration that fancy themselves modern day Kissingers or Bismarcks doing very complicated, you know, balance of power theory in the Middle East. But they're just mistaking the basics of the region and they believe the United States should act as an honest broker when the United States' role in the Middle East is to act as the leader of an alliance bloc built in opposition to the Iranian regime and terrorist groups that seek to destroy our interests.
You know, new equilibrium theory is a long way of saying utter failure. Because it's just an utter failure. Congressman Gallagher, I had a fourth question, but you're a Packers fan. I'm sure you'd trot off the field.
You're breaking up.
I'm sure you wouldn't be here for the fourth question. So I will get it to you next week on Antitrust. Representative Mike Gallagher, follow him on Twitter at Rep Gallagher. Follow me to the next segment, America. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Brian Westbury, Chief Economist at First Trust Portfolio. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, Hugh. Great to be with you this week.
Thank you. The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell testified yesterday that increases in prices have been larger than central bankers had expected and may prove more persistent, but he underscored his view that shortages, including of used cars, computer chips, and workers, will fade over time, bringing inflation closer to the Fed's 2% target. Bob Prince chimed in. He runs Bridgewater Associates with Ray Dalio and Greg Jensen, saying that, look, price rises, you're going to get some inflation, but it will be moderate and it will not be global. Your reaction, Brian Westbury?
With the Fed in December of last year, so we only have 5 months of data for this year. December was saying 1.8% inflation in 2021. Then in March, they raised that to 2.4%. And then in last week, they raised it to 3.4%. It's actually going to end up over 4.5%. And it is true that shortages of semiconductors and what's then happened to used cars, lumber, all of these things, a lot of it has to do with the pandemic and supply chain problems. And the government handing out money for people to spend when they're not producing anything. When you have too much demand and not enough supply, you do get a kind of driven inflation that's not real inflation. As Ludwig von Mises, Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, they are all economists that people should know. They said that inflation was printing money. So if you think about this, the Federal Reserve has added 30% more money into the system than we had in February of 2020. Unless we increase all the goods and services in the United States by 30% above where we were pre-COVID, that means we have more money chasing fewer goods. In other words, we have to. There's no way we're going to recover all of our GDP and then boost our GDP by 30% anytime soon. So we have too much money chasing too few goods, even if we fix those supply chain problems, that money, because there's too much of it, will buy less.
Now, Brian, the number one long tail product is housing. And I note a related couple of stories. Blackstone, which I think is the finest run investment firm in the United States, founded by Steve Schwarzman, bought Home Partners of America yesterday for $6 billion. That's 17,000 more homes in the Blackstone portfolio. While the Financial Times was reporting that house prices climbed to record levels in the U.S. and Europe, with U.S. existing home prices jumping 23.6%. Now, the problem is you can't turn out more houses. The planning tail, the entitlement tail, the acquisition tail, the construction tail, it's years and years. So you will not be able to catch up on housing in any kind of reasonable range. And that will drive inflation everywhere as lumber, et cetera, as people building scarce and highly desired houses go out and bid up everything that goes into a house.
Yep, that's exactly right. No, houses are, I mean, real estate is a great investment. For the past year, I've been telling people to buy a broad basket of commodities, stay invested in their real estate, buy materials companies who make these products to build houses, to build, you know, just about anything, and because they're all going to benefit from rising prices. And yes, we have shortages, and now we don't have enough workers. We're paying people not to work. All of that causes inflation, or at least rising prices. What Powell said that is true is eventually, once we stop paying people not to work, once supply chains heal, that will go away. So that part of the inflation is transitory. But I'm into repeating myself because this is the key ingredient. If you print more money, so think about it. If we have a bumper crop of corn, then the price of corn goes down. And so if you have a bumper crop of dollars, then the value of the dollar goes down. It buys less house. It buys less car. It buys less of everything because there's more dollars have been printed than goods and services that we created.
So, Brian, quick exit question.
Driver of inflation.
If you think it's going to be 4.3% this year, what's your projection for 2022, the annual inflationary rate?
Yeah, probably 4 to 4.5% for 2022. So when you print 30%, unless you increase your output, you will end up with 30% inflation. And I don't mean per year. So I don't know whether that shows up over 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. But you take 30% divided by whatever time you think it takes, and that's how much inflation we're going to have over those years.
Brian Westbury, thank you. Follow him on Twitter at Westbury, WESBURY. Follow me to Hour 3 of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi to my Canadian listeners. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. The lead story of the day, of course, the Cleveland Cavaliers coming up number 3 in the draft lottery last night. Jalen Green will be headed to Cleveland probably if Mobley goes to the Astros and Cade Cunningham to the Detroit Pistons. The Washington Wizards fans, among them long-suffering Fred Barnes, weep gently in the corner as yet another dream is dashed. Hello, Fred. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm still basking in the fact that the Wizards made the playoffs this year. Didn't see anybody from Cleveland there, but there they were. There were the Wizards. They've got a long ways to go, but they had a great comeback this year. I'm going to be at every game this coming year.
Well, you know, someday you're going to invite me when Sexton Youngbull and Darius Garland come along and now Jalen Green, because we are the new dynasty. You heard it here first. Fred, I want to talk to you about the Republican Party getting organized on the issues. The Republican Study Committee held a conference last week on the big issues on which the party needs a consensus position. And they identified Jim Banks as their chair, very smart young congressman from Indiana, immigration, China, and big tech. Now, I think there's a consensus on immigration and China. What do you think is, or can there even be, a consensus on big tech?
I think there cannot be an agreement on big tech, and for a number of reasons. But one reason is that most Americans, or at least I think most Americans, are not all whipped up about big tech. And I mean, are they all mad at Facebook and all these other things? I don't think they are. I don't think it's an issue that Republicans can, one, agree on, and two, because there isn't a lot that it's not going to help them. It's not going to get votes. Now, on these other ones, they can do it, but not on that one. I think big tech is something that most Americans are not mad about.
Now, within the room, there was a division between people who are upset about using antitrust to go after simply big companies like Amazon, Google, and Facebook. And then there were people like me who don't care about how large a company is, but I don't like the looting of personal data. I do not like to be nudged by people who are taking my data without paying for it, using terms and conditions that are unreadable, and using that data to manipulate me. So I argued that privacy and the protection of personal property, your data, is where the Republicans ought to put the stake in the ground on big tech. What do you think, Fred?
Well, I agree with you, but Republicans haven't come together on all this yet. I mean, look, I think they need to pay attention to the issues that are right in front of them, and they're ready to use. Immigration is certainly a big one. Will the big tax increases come from Biden and Democrats? And look, right now, at this whole voting issue, the whole thing now, Democrats want to have the federal government take over how voting is done in the United States. I think that's unconstitutional, among other things, but it's also incredibly unpopular.
Yes.
And all Republicans are really making an issue of on this voting thing is whether the voters have to show some kind of identification to be eligible to vote, to actually vote on something sometime within the year of Election Day. And Democrats are against that. The Democrats are not going to win that. They're lying about almost everything they say about it. And look, Republicans just have good issues without worrying about the big tech. And look, I mean, I just don't worry about that. I don't think enough people do. Now, you may get mad at Amazon and so on. I have in the past, but it's not an issue that's going to really lift the Republican Party. I think they're doing pretty well.
Mainly they are.
Mistakes by Democrats.
Let me make another issue on the menu for you. This is Ron DeSantis talking yesterday. Cue up cut 27, please. He is talking about an education reform in Florida, which I think is modeled on what Doug Ducey did in Arizona by requiring every graduating high school senior as a condition of their diploma to be able to pass the citizenship test that naturalized Americans must do to move from permanent resident to citizenship status. Here's Governor DeSantis yesterday, cut 27.
The curriculum can really provide a guide to how that should be done. The bill also expands our previous efforts in civics to add a requirement for the high school government class that students receive instruction on the evils of communism and totalitarian ideologies. We have a number of people in Florida, particularly southern Florida, who've escaped totalitarian regimes, who've escaped communist dictatorships to be able to come to America. We want all students to understand the difference. Why would somebody flee across shark-infested waters, say, leaving from Cuba to come to southern Florida? Why would somebody leave a place like Vietnam? Why would people leave these countries and risk their life to be able to come here? It's important that students understand that. Now, as part of this bill, Florida will create a Portraits and Patriotism Library so students can learn about real patriots who came to this country after seeing the horrors of these communist regimes. We actually have folks here today. You'll hear from her in a minute, Anna Abauza. She came to the United States when she was a teenager, fleeing from Nicaragua when the Sandinistas brought socialism to that country. She graduated from the University of Florida.
What do you think, Fred, about this is the opposite of critical race theory? It's critical regime theory.
Democrats will go crazy. They'll be against it. They'll block. And I think I agree that particularly people who were here, got here illegally or got here legally and want to become citizens ought to have some learning to do about America and why we're a free country and so on. But Democrats will hate it. They'll block it. So I don't know that Republicans can make some real headway in passing something. It sounds good anyway. I just don't think it's going to be something that becomes a major issue.
Now, the last one on the possible agenda is crime. Now, crime is not really a federal issue. It just isn't. Nevertheless, I think we're going to see a lot of Republicans talk about what is in fact becoming a crisis in places like Minneapolis, West Coast cities, and occasionally New York, which is a return to the bad old days. What do you think of that on the issue set?
I think that's a great issue, and Republicans ought to use it all the time. They have in the past. It's an issue that people care about enormously. And if crime is soaring in some place where you live, you're not going to care whether the federal government has to do something about it or the local government or something. They want law enforcement to be strong at every level, and Republicans ought to push that. It's a great issue. They've used it in the past. Use it again.
So, Fred, the one that I don't think has traction, because there is really not much credibility, is spending. Now, inflation matters. It wasn't here when Trump spent wildly. But Biden is spending exponentially more money than Trump, who spent lots more than Obama, who spent lots more than Bush. Is there any traction left for the deficit hawks? I don't think so. But what's Fred Barnes think?
Yeah, I'm afraid the deficit hawks, it's hard to find two or three of them. It's just. I blame Trump for that as a Republican. He gave up that issue, and for the moment, it's gone. I talked to a lot of people. You do, too. They're not really complaining about all this spending that Biden wants to do. And we'll get over that. Has already gotten away with some of it. But it's not the issue for Republicans that it once was.
Fred, I do think inflation might be. You remember the bad old 70s. You probably bought a house when the interest rates were double digit as opposed to 3% now. Does that offer opportunity for the Republicans to draw a line in the sand around inflationary spending? Because there are two kinds, spending that doesn't increase inflation and that which does.
Well, we have to see inflation. You know, it has to actually produce it. And we've already seen that. Inflation has gone up. I mean, look, people notice inflation when it happens because they're paying more for everything. And that can be an issue that works. But we haven't gotten there yet where the public is really concerned about inflation. But it might happen. And no thanks to Republicans and Trump probably. But the people will notice. They notice it when they have to spend more for everything.
Especially Cavaliers tickets. I don't think the Wizards tickets will be going up next year, but Cavaliers tickets sure will be if they don't trade that third pick away. Fred Barnes, always a pleasure. Go off and take a look at the mock drafts. I don't think the Wizards are even listed in the mock drafts, but keep your eye on the Cavs. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right.